Buddhist Summer School, Monday, 25th August, 1980. Venerable Sirs and friends, when an inquirer, a seeker after the religious life, came to the Buddha and asked questions, the Buddha, time and again, gave what was called a graduated talk, something which was suitable for the person who was there. And of course, a Buddha has the vision to be able to see exactly what the person is like who has come to him. Appearances do not deceive a Buddha, but they tell the Buddha everything about oneself. So he gave a graduated talk. And then if he noticed that that person's heart was uplifted and his mind was softened, then he proceeded to give him the knowledge that the Buddhas have won, and pointed out the way and so on. Finally, at the end, if the inquirer was really deeply moved, then he would ask for the ordination into the order of monks, and then would follow those immortal words of the Buddha, "Ehi bhikkhu, Svakkhato dhammo chara brahmacharyam samadukkhasa antakiriyaya. Come bhikkhu, well expounded is the dhamma. Tread the brahma path, live the holy life," in other words, in order to make a complete end of all ill. Then that man was received into the order. And this group of people who formed the order are constituted the Sangha. The three aspects, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, constitute, as far as I can see, a triune unity. They are all one body, actually. The Sangha was the gathering together of those who were intent upon the religious life. And here we can remind ourselves of what I said yesterday, I think. Cicero, using the word re legere in explaining the meaning of the word religion, a gathering together. And here was a gathering together which was a very remarkable unity. We may call it the committee of the ordained monks. There were no caste distinctions amongst them. One of the Buddha's great disciples, as he turned out to be, was the robber, the Angulimala by name. And it's a very delightful account of how he took to the teaching of the Buddha. But I won't go into that now. You can read it in the books. Another was a barber, and so on. People from all classes became monks, and they formed one single sangha, one gathered unity, in which there were no distinctions of caste. But the sangha was a hierarchical order. The novices were taught by those who had been already members and had progressed on the path for a certain number of years. And so it was built up like that. And two of the greatest of the members of the Sangha, as you all know, were Sariputta and Moggallana. There were others too also who were very great. And the Buddha names them and explains in one of the discourses the special qualities which distinguish them. So it was a hierarchical order. They lived together. They taught each other. They also tended each other in sickness. There was an instance where one monk who suffered from dysentery was neglected. And the Buddha, walking along, saw him and inquired of the monk, why are you in this condition by yourself, alone, surrounded by your own dirt, and so forth? Why is it that you have not been attended? And he said, Lord, I am only one of the lesser ones, and I wasn't taken notice of. And of course, the beloved monk, the Buddha's cousin Ananda, was with the Buddha. So the Buddha said, go Ananda, go and fetch water. And so between them, they washed that monk, cleansed him, and brought him into a comfortable position. And afterwards the Buddha called a meeting, a special meeting, and pointed out to the monks, you have no father or mother, you have no one to attend you here, no relatives to attend you. It is your duty to tend any fellow monk as if he were your own son or brother, and look after him as long as he needs to be looked after. And this was one of the very interesting practices in the order, that when anyone was ill, even if the superior monk was in meditation or something, he would have to obey the call of the sick one and come and tend him. A deed of mercy was far more important than one's own meditation for one's own advancement and benefit. This is quite a touching story, I think, and one well worth considering. How metta and karuna were cultivated amongst them in action. People often say that the Buddha's teaching does not touch social life or ordinary personal private life in any intimate way. This is quite a mistaken idea. If you look at the Mahamangala Sutta, the Buddha is asked, what is the greatest blessing in the world? And he talks a good deal about it in terms like this: to cherish wife and child, to look after your father and mother, and so forth. All that constitutes the greatest blessing. And in the Sigalovada Sutta, he gives in very great detail what relationships should prevail between members of the family, between teacher and pupil, between employer and employee, between friend and friend, and so on. So he was just as much concerned with the ordinary people as he was with the monks. But the monks were the people, the Sangha was the group to which all the deep teachings and the methods of training were imparted. Now the Sangha lived as a single body, knit together by mutual regard and love. And it's very interesting to note that here we have a sutta in which three of the monks were in retreat, Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbila, and they lived just by themselves practicing the discipline. And the Buddha, as he approached them, was seen by the keeper of the grove, and apparently he tried to prevent the Buddha from coming along, because these three were in retreat just by themselves and not to be disturbed. But and the keeper spoke to the Lord, saying, "There are three young men of family staying here, desiring self. Do not cause them discomfort." But one of the members, Anuruddha, sees that it is the teacher himself coming, and he says to his fellow students, "Let us go forth and meet the Lord, because he, our teacher, is coming to us." And then when the Buddha comes along, he says, "I hope that things are going well with you, Anuruddhas." He addresses all three with the plural of Anuruddha, calls all three of them Anuruddha. And it's rather significant that he does so. "I hope you are keeping going. I hope you are not short of alms food." Human concern, ordinary human concern, courtesy, kindness. "Things are going well, Lord. We are keeping going, and we are not short of alms food." And the Buddha says, "I hope that you, Anuruddhas, are living all together on friendly terms and harmonious, as milk and water blend, regarding one another with the eye of affection." The Buddha had a genius for similes. Like milk and water blend. Now those of you who have done chemistry at school and university know very well that there are certain liquids which, if you mix, you can never separate them again. Milk and water are a case in point. You can't evaporate off the water separately and let the pure milk be left behind. Can't be done. Once blended, it is completely, there is a complete blending. So he uses that simile, which is very significant. And milk, that which gives sustenance to babes and even to grown-ups. "Yes, certainly, Lord, we are all living together on friendly terms and harmonious, as milk and water blend, regarding one another with the eye of affection." And how is it that you are living together on friendly terms, as milk and water blend, regarding one another with the eye of affection? Now, Anuruddha answers, "As to this, Lord, it occurred to me, indeed, it is a gain for me, well gotten by me, that I am living with such fellow Brahmafaras. On account of this, Lord, for these venerable ones, friendliness as to acts of body, whether openly or in private, has risen up in me. Friendliness as to acts of speech, friendliness as to acts of thought, whether openly or in private, has risen up in me. Because of this, Lord, it occurred to me, now suppose that I, having surrendered my own mind, should live only according to the mind of these venerable ones. So I, Lord, having surrendered my own mind, am living only according to the mind of these venerable ones. We have diverse bodies, but assuredly only one mind. This is an extraordinarily strong affirmation of the very deep link which grows up between fellow monks. And this must have been characteristic certainly of the Sangha as it was in the early days when the Buddha himself formed it. So they lived as a single body knit together by mutual regard and love. Note what was required: the surrendering of one's own mind. No self-intrusion or self-imposition upon others. Selflessness. And the unselfed person is the one who can best serve his fellow beings. He gives up his own mind. He doesn't want to impose his own ideas or say, look, I'm very busy, don't come and bother me now, etc. Oh no. What can I do for you? Always. Always it was the other person who, thereby being linked with oneself to that in that intense manner, was one with oneself. And therefore there was a real unity, a bond of love which was true and sincere, which had no possessiveness, which had no envy, no jealousy involved in it. So the Sangha must have been a kind of a haven of love, a saranam, where love prevailed. Maitri, Karuna, Mudita and Upekha, all of them. A haven of love in that sense. And a haven of love is the thing. True love leads to happiness and to a haven of peace. There is that wonderful account in the Samanya Phala Sutta, in the amongst the long discourses, where King Ajatasattu of Magadha is entranced one full moon night. It was the October full moon. He's absolutely entranced with the beauty of that full moon, and he desires to hear religious discourse. So he asks different courtiers where he should go, and they suggest the names of various teachers who were prevalent, who had their own followings in those days. But he has already spoken to them and he is not satisfied. He had already spoken to them on past occasions and he was not satisfied. Then his physician, Dr. Jivaka. Jivaka. Jiva means life. So Jivaka must have been life preserver or life maker, almost. Dr. Jivaka talks about the Buddha and says, let us go and visit him. And the king consents, and the elephants are called out, the women of the court, of the harem, I suppose, in that case, really. And other courtiers mounted the elephants and went along to the nearby woodland where the Buddha was with 1,250 monks. After a time, it was not possible for the elephants to move along that because it wasn't a road that a mighty creature like an elephant could traverse. So they had to get down and go on foot. And there came the point when the king was seized with fear that this might be a trap to ambush him, to slay him maybe. He himself had murdered his father, the good king Bimbisara, Senia Bimbisara, and the sense of guilt was strong in him on that account. But Dr. Jivaka assures him that this peace, this perfect quiet which is around here, is no trap. And finally, they come upon the place where there was the Buddha with 1,250 monks all sitting perfectly silently. And the king was very moved by this. And he said, "Would that my son Udai Buddha enjoy such peace as this." Obviously the king himself was never at peace. And the Buddha says to him, Do your thoughts then go where your love takes you?" And he said, "I love the boy, and I wish he could enjoy peace of this sort." And then he sits down and asks his question. "What is the fruit here and now of living the holy life?" And the Buddha gives one of his longest discourses. It's a very full discourse, telling the king everything. The king listens, and then, of course, he has to go back, so he leaves. But before he leaves, he expresses regret that he had murdered his father. And the Buddha accepts that confession and of regret and remorse, and says, it will be to your good that you see that you have done wrong. And then the king departs. But that is a very remarkable account of what sort of a place it was where the Sangha resided or gathered together. A haven of peace, a haven of love, quite the sort of ideal human society. Here were people who had become complete human beings. Their humanity was fully realized. Now, the Buddha sends out members of the Sangha. Soon after he started teaching, 60 people had become arhats. The first 60 perfected ones, the Buddha says, "Walk, bhikkhus, on tour for the blessing of the many folk, for the happiness of the many folk, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, for the blessing, the happiness of devas and men." It's very interesting. The first group he sends out are for the sake of the many folk. That means all people, not to any exclusive group, but to all mankind. And for their happiness, for their blessing, for their well-being, for their welfare. So that the statements that the Buddha was unconcerned with the masses as such has no foundation whatever, really. Then, 40 years later, shortly before his death, he says at the Kutagara Hall, "Therefore, bhikkhus, ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and the gain and the weal of devas and men. Those were his words shortly before his death too. So we see that the Buddha himself, of course, who was the embodiment of compassion and wisdom, was concerned with all humanity, was concerned with the complete release from all dukkha, all ill, and it was to help mankind to free itself from all ill that he sent out the members of the Sangha. It gives us some sort of, if we think about this carefully, if we have sufficient imagination to visualize what the Sangha must have been like and how it functioned, we will see it as a very, very remarkable body. In the history of Buddhism, there has been no such thing as the martyrdom of the members of the Sangha, anything like the martyrdom of the early Christians, the first Christians. India was a country which always welcomed and supported the truly religious, and all true religious teaching was received with open arms wheresoever it came from. That's why India has been the mother of all the religions. Every single religion in the world flourishes in India, and it has millions of followers. The one exception where the number of followers is concerned is the Zarathustrian people, because they are only a very small population. There are only 120,000 or so of us in the whole world, enough to fill one suburb of London or Birmingham. That's all. So the number of Zarathustrians doesn't run into millions. And the number of Jews also is somewhat small. But otherwise, the other religions flourish by the million there in India. India has never believed in exclusiveness where religion is concerned, because the Hindus have always said right from the beginning, no one has the monopoly of truth. You may recall what Sri Krishna said in the Gita: by whatsoever path a man approaches me, on that path do I meet him. So, that which is transcendent, that which is the perfect, makes no distinction as regards the path which a man treads to reach that transcendence, that fulfillment. Now, we may ask, what was the kind of teaching which was given out? What are some of the most important aspects of the teaching? You all know, of course, the Four Noble Truths, the Four Arya Satchani. Sorry, I sometimes forget nowadays. You all know about that. Now, but if you study the Mahavagga, you will find it opening with the statement that after the night that on the night of the enlightenment, the Buddha went through a process, a particular process, which was called the Paticca Samuppada, dependent or causal origination. And it consisted of 12 aspects, starting with avidya, or the Sanskrit avidya, that was the first, ignorance, then sankhara, the conformations or volitions, and the third is vijnana, discriminative consciousness. The next is nama rupa. The next is, that is the body, the psychophysical organism, nama rupa. The next is salayatana, the six sense fields. Note carefully, six always, not five. Our ordinary five sense fields of sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, and also the ordinary thinking, feeling process which goes on in the brain. That is the sixth. The Hindus have always considered that aspect which has been loosely termed mind, which is actually the psychical activity of the living person. They have always considered that as material, not as mental, in the real sense of the word mental, purely mental. They've regarded it as belonging to the realm of matter, and they were not far wrong in that. And the six sense fields, and because of the six sense fields, there is contact, fassa, with the outer world, and as a result of that contact with the outer world, there is sensation, feeling, vedana, and out of vedana there arises a hard core, which is tanha, the thirst for sentient existence, principally, and craving, generally speaking, tanha. Trishna is the Sanskrit word, which in Pali we say is tanha, thirst for sentient existence. And out of the thirst for sentient existence, there arises upadana, the uprising of desire for this, that, or the other, which leads to bhava, the becoming of that thing, which leads to jati, the actual precipitation in physical life of that thing, and the inevitable jara marana afterwards, which is the process of decay and age, decaying, aging, and dying, associated with grief, sadness, tears, and all the rest of it. Dukkha, domanassa, etc. All that lot. Now these 12 items constitute that circle of Paticca Samuppada. It is usually presented in the form that one is the cause of the other, and that is the cause of the third, and that is the cause of the fourth. I think it would be better if we regarded the whole circle of 12 as interdependent forces at play, not one as the cause of the next one, and so forth. If any one of them really was out of the picture, the whole cycle of ill would fall down, like a pack of cards, like a house of cards. you raise up a structure, but if you just touch one and get it out of position, the whole lot will fall down. And this paticca samuppada was the rationale of dukkha. This is how dukkha arises, and then the teaching goes on to say, by the extinction of avidya, sankhara is extinguished, and that extinguishes vijnana, discriminative consciousness, and nama rupa, and so on. But consider carefully. If nama rupa, the psychophysical organism, and discriminative consciousness were extinguished, who is there to practice the discipline and live to be released from the domination of ill? To what then does the paticca samuppada really apply? It applies to the thought process which goes on continuously in each and every one of us. Don't extinguish the nama rupa. Some people have sought liberation by suicide and so forth, but I'm afraid they only ended up in the grave thereby. So this paticca samuppada is concerned with the thought process. What was the Buddha's primary concern? His concern was to help people to purify the entire psyche. The psyche was the thing where all these mental processes went on. And the paticca samuppada gives the psychological explanation of what goes on in the brain, in the psyche of the person, and helps him to understand, therefore, how all ill arises. And if he once really sees how all ill arises, he has the remedy in his own power to get free of that ill. So we must bear this in mind very, very carefully. If there were no, I'll use the word they always used, mind, they always used mind, I say psyche, where they said mind, in this context. They were concerned with this purification of the mind, and when that took place, ill was out of the picture. And the whole of the teaching, the Noble Eightfold Path, is directed towards the purification of the mind. The Buddha's primary concern was the mind itself, to free the mind, to bring about unconditional freedom of mind, which comes out very strongly in one of the early discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya. Because if you look at it carefully, you will see that supposing there were no mind, no psyche, there'd be no dukkha. It is simply because we are aware, conscious of this psychical process in ourselves, that there is dukkha. And it is in this life itself that we go through the series of births and deaths, rebirths and re-deaths. In this life itself, we go through the whole series psychically. The Maitri and the Shandilya Upanishad declare openly, samsara is just one's thought. When that is cleansed, there is liberation. This whole cycle of samsara ends. Don't think of it as births and deaths in the biological sense. Try and see it practically, here and now, in the psychological sense. And that will make all the difference to one's own life. And perhaps it would make us fit to become members of the Sangha. I think I've said enough about the Sangha as such to show what a wonderful body it is. It's the body of the Buddha in the same sense, that in a similar sense anyway, as that in which the Christians say that the members of the church are the body of Christ. And similarly, one may regard the Sangha as the body of the Buddha, continued through the centuries.